Fucker, I hate your sadistic guts. He made the 90 seconds and came up gasping. Dave dried his face with a towel. Stop this, he murmured in Luke's ear. Just tell me what I'm thinking. This time it's a movie star. Matt Damon, the bar sign in Dave's head now said. I don't know. Luke began to cry, the tears running down his wet face. Zeke said,
Fine. Let's go for a minute 45. 105 big seconds. And don't you forget to put a howdy-do between each one. We'll turn you into an abalone fisherman yet.
Luke hyperventilated again, but by the time he reached 100, counting in his head, he felt sure he was going to open his mouth and suck in water. They would haul him out, resuscitate him, and do it again. They would keep on until he either told them what they wanted to hear or drowned. At last, the hand on his head was gone. He surged up, gasping and coughing. They gave him time to recover. Then Zeke said,
Never mind the animals and the sports teams and the whatever. Just say it. Say, I'm a Talep. I'm TP. And this stops.
Okay. Okay, I'm a Talep.
Great, Zeke cried. Progress. What number am I thinking of?
The bright bar sign read 17. 6, Luke said. Zeke made a game show buzzer sound.
Sorry, it was 17. 2 minutes this time.
No, I can't, please. Dave spoke quietly.
Last one, Luke.
Zeke gave his colleague a shoulder shove almost hard enough to knock him off his feet.
Don't tell him what might not be true.
He returned his attention to Luke.
I'll give you 30 seconds to get fully aerated and then down you go. Olympic diving team, baby.
With no choice, Luke inhaled and exhaled rapidly. But long before he could count to 30 in his head, Zeke's hand closed on his hair and shoved him down. Luke opened his eyes and stared at the white side of the tank. The paint was scratched in a couple of places, maybe by the fingernails of other children subjected to this torture, which was reserved strictly for pinks. And why? It was pretty obvious. Because Hendricks and Evans thought the range of psychic talents could be expanded, and pinks were expendable. Expand, expend, he thought. Expand, expend. Calm. Calm, calm. And although he tried his best to enter a zen-like state, his lungs eventually demanded more air. His zen-like state, which hadn't been very zen-like to begin with, broke down when he thought that if he survived this, he'd be forced to go 2 minutes and 15, then 2 minutes and 30. Then he began to thrash. Zeke held him down. He planted his feet and pushed, almost made it to the surface, but Zeke added his other hand and pushed him down again. The dots came back, flashing in front of his eyes, rushing toward him, pulling back, then rushing toward him again. They started to swirl around him like a carousel gone crazy. Luke thought, the Stasi lights. I'm gonna drown looking at the... Zeke hauled him up by the hair. His white tunic was soaked. He looked fixedly at Luke.
I'm gonna put you down again, Luke. Again and again and again. I'll put you down until you drown, and then we'll resuscitate you, and drown you again, and resuscitate you again. Last chance. What number am I thinking of?
I don't... Luke retched out water. No. That fixed gaze remained for perhaps 5 seconds. Luke met it, although his eyes were gushing tears. Then Zeke said,
Fuck this and fuck you, sport. Dave... Dry him off and send him back. I don't want to look at his little cunt face.
He left, slamming the door. Luke floundered from the pool, staggered, almost fell. Dave steadied him, then handed him a towel. Luke dried himself and got back into his clothes as fast as he could. He didn't want to be anywhere near this man or this place. But even feeling half dead, his curiosity remained. Why is it so important? Why is it so important when it isn't even what we're here for? How would you know what you're here for? Dave asked. Because I'm not stupid, that's why. You want to keep your mouth shut, Luke, Dave said. I like you, but that doesn't mean I want to listen to you run your mouth. Whatever the dots are for,
It doesn't have anything to do with finding out if I can go both ways, TP as well as TK. What are you guys doing? Do you even
Dave slapped him, a big roundhouse that knocked Luke off his feet. Water puddled on the tile floor, soaked into the seat of his jeans.
I'm not here to answer your questions.
He bent toward Luke.
We know what we're doing, smartass. We know exactly what we're doing.
And as he hauled Luke up, we had a kid here last year who lasted 3.5 minutes. He was a pain in the ass, but at least he had balls.
12.
Avery came to his room, concerned, and Luke told him to go away. He needed to be alone for a while.
It was bad, wasn't it?
Avery asked.
The tank. I'm sorry, Luke.
Thanks. Now go away. We'll talk later.
Okay.
Avery went, considerately closing the door behind him. Luke lay on his back, trying not to relive those endless minutes submerged in the tank and doing it anyway. He kept waiting for the lights to come back, bobbing and racing through his field of vision, turning circles and making dizzy whirlpools. When they didn't, he began to calm. One thought trumped all others, even his fear that the dots might come back and stay this time. Get out. I have to get out. And if I can't do that, I have to die before they take me to back half and take the rest of me.
13. The worst of the bugs had departed with June, so Dr. Hendricks met with Zeke Ioannidis in front of the administration building, where there was a bench under a shady oak tree. Nearby was a flagpole, with the stars and stripes flapping lazily in a light summer breeze. Dr. Hendricks held Luke's folder on his lap.
You're sure?
He said to Zeke.
Positive. I dunked the little bastard 5 or 6 times, I guess. Each one 15 seconds longer, just like you said. If he could read minds, he would have done it. And you can take that to the bank. A Navy SEAL couldn't stand up to that shit, let alone a kid not old enough to have more than 6 hairs on his balls.
Hendricks seemed ready to push it, then sighed and shook his head.
All right. I can live with that. We've got plenty of pinks right now, and more due in. An embarrassment of riches. But it's still a disappointment. I had hopes for that boy.
He opened the file with its little pink dot in the upper right-hand corner. He took a pen from his pocket and drew a diagonal line across the first page.
At least he's healthy. Evans gave him a clean bill. That idiot girl, Benson, didn't pass her chicken pox on to him.
He wasn't vaccinated against that, Zeke said.
He was, but she took pains to swap spit with him. And she had quite a serious case. Couldn't risk it. Nope. Better safe than sorry. So when does he go to back half?
Hendricks smiled a little.
Can't wait to get rid of him, can you? Actually, no, Zeke said. The Benson girl might not have infected him with chicken pox, but Wilhelm passed on his fuck you germ.
He goes as soon as I get a green light from Heckel and Jekyll.
Zeke pretended to shiver.
Those two. Creepy.
Hendricks advanced no opinion on the back half doctors.
You're sure he's flat as far as telepathy goes?
Zeke patted him on the shoulder.
Absolutely, Doc. Take it to the bank.
14. While Hendricks and Zeke were discussing his future, Luke was on his way to lunch. As well as terrorizing him, the immersion tank had left him ravenously hungry. When Stevie Whipple asked where he'd been and what was wrong, Luke just shook his head. He didn't want to talk about the tank. Not now. Not ever. He supposed it was like being in a war. You got drafted. You went. But you didn't want to talk about what you'd seen. Or what had happened to you there. Full of the calf's version of fettuccine Alfredo, he took a nap and awoke feeling marginally better. He went looking for Maureen, and spied her in the formerly deserted East Wing. It seemed the Institute might soon be hosting more guests. He walked down to her and asked if she needed help. "Because I wouldn't mind earning some tokens," he said.
"No, I'm fine."
To Luke, she looked like she was aging almost by the hour. Her face was dead pale. He wondered how long it would be before someone noticed her condition and made her stop working. He didn't like to think about what might become of her if that happened. Was there a retirement program for housekeepers who were also Institute snitches? He doubted it. Her laundry basket was half filled with fresh linen, and Luke dropped his own note into it. He had written it on a memo sheet he'd stolen from the equipment alcove in C4, along with a cheap ballpoint pen which he'd hidden under his mattress. Stamped on the barrel of the pen was Denison River Bend Realty. Maureen saw the folded note, covered it with a pillowcase, and gave him a slight nod. Luke went on his way. That night in bed, he whispered to Avery for a long time before allowing the kid to go to sleep. "There were two scripts," he told Avery. "There had to be." He thought the Avester understood. Or maybe the right word was hoped. Luke stayed awake a long time, listening to Avery's light snores and meditating on escape. The idea seemed simultaneously absurd and perfectly possible. There were those dusty surveillance bulbs, and all the times he'd been left alone to wander, gathering in his little bits and bobs of information. There were the fake surveillance dead zones that Sigsby and her minions knew about, and the real one that they didn't, or so he hoped. In the end, it was a pretty simple equation. He had to try. The alternative was the Stasi lights, the movies, the headaches, the sparkler that triggered whatever it triggered, and at the end of it all, the drone.
"When they stop testing, you might only have 3 days."
15. The following afternoon, Trevor Stackhouse joined Mrs. Sigsby in her office. She was bent over an open file, reading and making notes. She raised a single finger without looking up. He went to her window, which looked out on the east wing of the building they called the residence hall, as if the Institute really were a college campus, one that happened to be situated in the deep woods of northern Maine. He could see two or three kids milling around snack and soda machines that had just been restocked. There was no tobacco or alcohol available in that lounge, hadn't been since 2005. The East Wing was usually thinly populated or not populated at all, and when there were residents boarded there, they could get cigarettes and wine nips from the vending machines at the other end of the building. Some only sampled, but a surprising number, usually those who were the most depressed and terrified by the sudden catastrophic change in their lives, became addicted quickly. Those were the ones who gave the least trouble, because they didn't just want tokens, they needed them. Karl Marx had called religion the opiate of the people, but Stackhouse begged to differ. He thought Lucky Strikes and Boone's Farm, greatly favored by their female guests, did the job quite nicely.
"Okay," Mrs. Sigsby said, closing her file. "Ready for you, Trevor."
4 more coming in tomorrow from Opal Team," Stackhouse said. His hands were clasped behind his back and his feet were spread apart.
Like a captain on the foredeck of his ship, Mrs. Sigsby thought. He was wearing one of his trademark brown suits, which she would have thought a terrible choice for midsummer, but he no doubt considered it part of his image.
"We haven't had this many on board since 2008. He turned from the view, which really wasn't that interesting. Sometimes, often even, he got very tired of children. He didn't know how teachers did it, especially without the freedom to whack the insolent and administer a splash of electricity to the rebellious, like the now departed Nicholas Wilholm. Mrs. Sigsby said,
"There was a time, long before yours and mine, when there were over 100 children here. There was a waiting list."
"All right, there was a waiting list. Good to know. Now, what did you call me here for?"
The Opal team is in place, and at least one of these pickups is going to be delicate. I'm flying out tonight. The kid's in a closely supervised environment.
A rehab, you mean?
That is correct. High-functioning TKs seem to get along relatively well in society, but similarly, high-functioning TPs had problems, and often turned to booze or drugs. They damped the torrent of input, Stackhouse supposed. But she's worth it. Not up there with the Dixon boy, he's a powerhouse, but close. So tell me, what's concerning you, and let me go about my business.
Not a concern, just a heads up. And don't hover behind me, it gives me the willies. Drag up a rock.
While he got the visitor's chair from the other side of her desk, Mrs. Sigsby opened a video file on her desktop and started it playing. It showed the snack machines outside the cafeteria. The picture was cloudy. It jittered every 10 seconds or so, and was occasionally interrupted by static frizz. Mrs. Sigsby paused it during one of these.
The first thing I want you to notice, she said, using the dry lecture hall voice he had so come to dislike, is the quality of this video. It's totally unacceptable. The same is true of at least half the surveillance cams. The one in that shitty little convenience store in the Bend is better than most of ours.
Meaning Denison River Bend. And it was true. I'll pass that on, but we both know the basic infrastructure of this place is shit. The last total renovation was 40 years ago, when things in this country were different. A lot looser. As it stands, we have just 2 IT guys, and one of them is currently on leave. The computer equipment is outdated, and so are the generators. You know all this. Mrs. Sigsby absolutely did. It wasn't lack of funds. It was their inability to bring in outside help. Your basic catch-22, in other words. The Institute had to stay airtight, and in the age of social media and hackers, that became ever more difficult. Even a whisper of what they were up to out here would be the kiss of death. For the vitally important work they did, yes. But also for the staff. It made hiring hard. It made resupply hard. And repairs were a nightmare.
That fritzing is coming from kitchen equipment, he said. Mixers, garbage disposals, the microwaves. I might be able to get something done about that.
Perhaps you can even get something done about the bulbs in which the cameras are enclosed. Something low-tech. I believe it's called dusting. We do have janitors.
Stackhouse looked at his watch.
All right, Trevor, I can take a hint.
She started the video again. Maureen Alverson appeared with her cleaning basket. She was accompanied by 2 residents, Luke Ellis and Avery Dixon, the exceptional TP Paz who was now bunking in with Ellis most nights. The video might have been substandard, but the audio was good.
We can talk here, Maureen told the boys. There's a mic, but it hasn't worked for years. Just smile a lot, so if anyone looks at the video, they think you're buttering me up for tokens. Now what's on your minds? And keep it short.
There was a pause. The little boy scratched at his arms, pinched his nostrils, then looked at Luke. So Dixon was only along for the ride. This was Ellis's deal. Stackhouse wasn't surprised. Ellis was the smart one. The chess player.
Well, Luke said, it's about what happened in the cafeteria, to Harry and the little G's. That's what's on our minds.
Maureen sighed and put down her basket.
I heard about it. It was too bad, but from what I hear, they're okay.
Really? All 3 of them? Maureen paused. Avery was staring up at her anxiously, scratching his arms, pinching his nose, and generally looking like he needed to pee. She said finally,
Maybe not okay right now? At least not completely. I heard Dr. Evans say they were taken to the infirmary in back half. They have a fine one there.
What else do they have?
Quiet.
She raised a hand to Luke and looked around. The picture fritzed, but the sound stayed clear.
Don't you ask me about back half. I can't talk about that, except to say it's nice. Nicer than front half. And after the boys and girls spend some time there, they go back home.
She had her arms around them when the video cleared, holding them close.
Look at that, Stackhouse said admiringly. Mother Courage. She's good.
Hush, Mrs. Sigsby said.
Luke asked Maureen if she was absolutely sure Harry and Greta were alive. Because they looked, well, dead.
Yeah, all the kids are saying that.
Avery agreed and gave his nose a particularly vicious honk.
Harry spazzed out and stopped breathing. Greta's head looked all crooked and weird on her neck.
Maureen didn't rush ahead. Stackhouse could see her choosing her words. He thought she might have made a decent intelligence agent in a place where intelligence gathering actually mattered. Meanwhile, both boys were looking up at her, waiting. At last, she said,
Of course, I wasn't there, and I know it must have been scary, but I have to think it looked much worse than it was.
She stopped again, but after Avery gave his nose another comforting squeeze, she pushed on.
If the crossboy had a seizure, I said if, they'll be giving him the correct medication. As for Greta, I was passing the break room and heard Dr. Evans tell Dr. Hendricks she's suffering from a sprained neck. They probably put her in a brace. Her sister must be with her. For comfort, you know?
Okay, Luke said, sounding relieved. As long as you're sure.
As sure as I can be, that's all I can tell you, Luke. A fair amount of lying goes on in this place, but I was raised not to lie to folks, especially not to children. So all I can say is I'm sure as I can be. Now, why is it so important? Just because you're worried about your friends, or is there something more?
Luke looked at Avery, who gave his nose an actual yank, then nodded. Stackhouse rolled his eyes.
Jesus Christ, kid. If you have to pick it, go on and pick it. The foreplay is driving me crazy.
Mrs. Sigsby paused the video.
It's a self-comforting gesture, and better than grabbing his basket. I've had a fair number of crotch grabbers in my time, girls as well as boys. Now be quiet. This is the interesting part.
If I tell you something, will you promise to keep it to yourself? Luke asked. She thought this over while Avery continued to torture his poor schnoz. Then she nodded. Luke lowered his voice. Mrs. Sigsby turned up the volume.
Some of the kids are talking about going on a hunger strike. No more food until we can be sure the little G's and Harry are all right.
Maureen lowered her own voice.
Which kids? I don't exactly know,
Luke said.
Some of the new ones. You tell them that would be a very bad idea. You're a smart boy, Luke, very smart. And I'm sure you know what the word reprisals means. You can explain it to Avery later.
She looked fixedly at the younger boy, who withdrew from her arm and put a protective hand to his nose, as if he were afraid she meant to grab it herself, maybe even pull it off.
Now I have to go. I don't want you guys to get in trouble, and I don't want to get in trouble myself. If someone asks what we were talking about, coaxing you for chores to get more tokes,
Avery said.
Got it. Good.
She glanced up at the camera, started away, then turned back.
You'll be out of here soon and back home. Until then, be smart. Don't rock the boat.
She grabbed a dust rag, gave the delivery tray of the booze-dispensing machine a quick wipe, then picked up her basket and left. Luke and Avery lingered a moment or two, then also went on their way. Mrs. Sigsby killed the video.
Hunger strike, Stackhouse said, smiling. That's a new one.
Yes,
Mrs. Sigsby agreed.
The very idea fills me with terror. His smile widened into a grin. Siggers might disapprove, but he couldn't help it. To his surprise, she actually laughed.
When did he last heard her do that? The correct answer might be never.
It does have its funny side. Growing children would make the world's worst hunger strikers. They're eating machines. But you're right. It's something new under the sun. Which of the new intakes do you think floated it?
Oh, come on. None of them.
We've only got one kid smart enough to even know what a hunger strike is, and he's been here for almost a month.
Yes,
she agreed.
And I'll be glad when he's out of front half. Wilhelm was an annoyance, but at least he was out front with his anger. Ellis, though, he's sneaky. I don't like sneaky children.
How long until he's gone?
Sunday or Monday, if Hallis and James in back half agree, which they will. Hendrix is pretty much through with him.
Good. Will you address this hunger strike idea or let it go? I'd suggest letting it go. It'll die a natural death, if it happens at all.
I believe I'll address it. As you say, we've currently got a lot of residents. And it might be well to speak to them at least once en masse.
If you do, Alice is probably going to figure out Alverson's a rat. Given the kid's IQ, there was no probably about it.
Doesn't matter. He'll be gone in a few days, and his nose-tweaking little friend will follow soon after. Now, about those surveillance cameras.
I'll write a memo to Andy Fellows before I leave tonight, and we'll make them a priority as soon as I'm back. He leaned forward, hands clasped, his brown eyes fixed on her steel-gray ones. In the meantime, lighten up. You'll give yourself an ulcer. Remind yourself at least once a day that we're dealing with kids, not hardened criminals. Mrs. Sigsby made no reply, because she knew he was right. Even Luke Ellis, smart as he might be, was only a kid. And after he spent some time in back half, he'd still be a kid, but he wouldn't be smart at all.
16. When Mrs. Sigsby walked into the cafeteria that night, slim and erect in a crimson suit, gray blouse, and single strand of pearls, there was no need for her to tap a spoon against a glass and call for attention. All chatter ceased at once. Techs and caretakers drifted into the doorway, giving on the West Lounge. Even the kitchen staff came out, gathering behind the salad bar.
As most of you know, Mrs. Sigsby said in a pleasant, carrying voice, there was an unfortunate incident here in the cafeteria two nights ago. There have been rumors and gossip that two children died in that incident. This is absolutely untrue. We do not kill children here in the Institute.
She surveyed them. They looked back, eyes wide, food forgotten.
In case some of you were concentrating on your fruit cocktail and not paying attention, let me repeat my last statement. We do not kill children. She paused to let that sink in. You did not ask to be here. We all understand that, but we do not apologize for it. You are here to serve not only your country, but the entire world. When your service is done, you will not be given medals. There will be no parades in your honor. You will not be aware of our heartfelt thanks because before you leave, your memories of the Institute will be expunged, wiped away, for those of you who don't know that word.
Her eyes found Luke's for a moment, and they said, but of course you know it.
Please understand that you have those thanks nonetheless. You will be tested in your time here, and some of the tests may be hard. But you will survive and rejoin your families. We have never lost a child.
She paused again, waiting for anyone to respond or object. Wilhelm might have, but Wilhelm was gone. Ellis didn't, because direct response wasn't his way. As a chess player, he preferred sneaky gambits to direct assault. Much good would it do him.
Harold Cross had a brief seizure following the visual field and acuity test some of you, those who have had it, call the dots or the lights. He inadvertently struck Greta Wilcox, who was trying, admirably, I'm sure we all feel, to comfort him. She suffered a severely sprained neck, but is recovering. Her sister is with her. The Wilcox twins and Harold are to be sent home next week. And I'm sure we will send our good wishes with them.
Her eyes again sought Luke, sitting at a table against the far wall. His little friend was with him. Dixon's mouth was hanging agape, but at least he was leaving his nose alone for the time being. "If anyone should contradict what I've just told you, you may be sure that person is lying, and his lie should be immediately reported to one of the caretakers or technicians. Is that understood?"
Silence, without even a nervous cough to break it.
"If it's understood, I would like you to say, 'Yes, Mrs. Sigsby.'"
"Yes, Mrs. Sigsby," the kids responded. She offered a thin smile.
"I think you can do better." "Yes, Mrs. Sigsby." "And now with real conviction." "Yes, Mrs. Sigsby."
This time, even the kitchen staff, techs, and caretakers joined in.
"Good," Mrs. Sigsby smiled. "There's nothing like an affirmative shout to clear the lungs and the mind, is there? Now carry on with your meals."
She turned to the white-coated kitchen staff.
"And extra desserts before bedtime. Assuming you can provide cake and ice cream, Chef Doug?"
Chef Doug made a circle with his thumb and forefinger. Someone began to clap. Others joined in. Mrs. Sigsby nodded right and left to acknowledge the applause as she left the room, walking with her head up and her hands swinging back and forth in tiny, precise arcs. A small smile, what Luke thought of as a Mona Lisa smile, curved the corners of her mouth. The white coats parted to let her pass. Still applauding, Avery leaned close to Luke and whispered,
"She lied about everything."
Luke gave an almost imperceptible nod.
"That fucking bitch," Avery said.
Luke gave the same tiny nod and sent a brief mental message. Keep clapping. 17. That night, Luke and Avery lay side by side in Luke's bed as the Institute wound down for another night. Avery whispered, recounting everything Maureen told him each time he went to his nose, signaling her to send. Luke had been afraid Maureen might not understand the note he dropped into her basket. A little unconscious prejudice there, maybe based on the brown housekeeper's uni she wore. He'd have to work on that. But she had understood perfectly and provided Avery with the step-by-step list. Luke thought the Avester could have been a little more subtle about the signals, but it seemed to have turned out okay. He had to hope it had. Supposing that were true, Luke's only real question was whether or not the first step could actually work. It was simple to the point of crudity. The two boys lay on their backs, staring into the dark. Luke was going over the steps for the 10th time, or maybe the 15th, when Avery invaded his mind with three words that flashed on like a red neon, then faded out, leaving an afterimage.
"Yes, Mrs. Sigsby."
Luke poked him. Avery sniggered. A few seconds later, the words came again, this time even brighter.
"Yes, Mrs. Sigsby."
Luke gave him another poke, and he was smiling. And Avery probably knew it, dark or not. The smile was in his mind as well as on his mouth, and Luke thought he had a right to it. He might not be able to escape the Institute. He had to admit the odds were against. But today had been a good one. Hope was such a fine word, such a fine thing to feel.
"Yes, Mrs. Sigsby, you fucking bitch."
"Stop or I'll tickle you," Luke murmured.
"It worked, didn't it?"
Avery whispered.
"It really worked. Do you think you can really?"
"I don't know. I only know I'm gonna try.
Now shut up and go to sleep." "I wish you could take me with you. I wish it bad."
"Me too," Luke said, and he meant it. It would be tough for Avery here on his own. He was more socially adjusted than the little G's or Stevie Whipple, but nobody was ever going to crown him Mr. Personality.
"When you come back, bring about 1,000 cops with you,"
Avery whispered.
"And do it fast, before they take me to back half. Do it while we can still save Shaw."
"I'll do what I can," Luke promised.
"Now stop yelling in my head. That joke wears out fast. I wish you had more TP, and that it didn't hurt you to send. We could talk better.
If wishes were horses, beggars would ride. For the last time, go to sleep.
Avery did, and Luke began to drift off himself. Maureen's first step was as clanky as the ice machine where they sometimes talked, but he had to admit that it tallied with all the things he'd already observed. Dusty camera housings, baseboards where paint had chipped off years ago and had never been touched up, an elevator card carelessly left behind. He mused again on how this place was like a rocket with its engines off, still moving, but now in an inertial glide.
18. The next day, Winona escorted him down to sea level, where he was given a quick once-over. Blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, O2 level. When Luke asked what came next, Dave checked his clipboard, gave him a sunny grin, as if he had never knocked him to the floor, and said there was nothing on the schedule.
You've got a day off, Luke. Enjoy it.
He raised his hand, palm out. Luke grinned back and slapped him 5. But it was Maureen's note he was thinking of.
When they stop testing, you might only have 3 days.
What about tomorrow? He asked as they returned to the elevator.
We'll let tomorrow take care of itself, Dave said. It's the only way to be. Maybe that was true for some, but it was no longer true for Luke. He wished for extra time to go over Maureen's plan, or to procrastinate, more like it, but he was afraid that his time was almost up.
Dodgeball had become a daily affair on the Institute's playground, almost a ritual, and nearly everyone joined in, at least for a while. Luke got in the circle and jostled around with the other Dodgers for 10 minutes or so before allowing himself to be hit. Instead of joining the throwers, he walked across the asphalt half court past Frieda Brown, who was standing by herself and taking foul shots. Luke thought she still had no real idea where she was. He sat down on the gravel with his back against the chain link fence. At least the bug situation was a little better now. He dropped his hands and swept them idly back and forth at his sides, eyes on the dodgeball game.
Want to shoot some?
Frieda asked.
Maybe later, Luke said. He casually reached one hand behind him, felt for the bottom of the fence, and found that yes, Maureen was right. There was a gap where the ground slumped a bit. That slump might have been created by snowmelt in the early spring. Only an inch or two, but it was there. Nobody had bothered to fill it in. Luke's upturned hand rested on the exposed bottom of the fence, the wire tines pressing into his palm. He waggled his fingertips in the free air outside the Institute for a moment or two, then got up, dusted off his bottom, and asked Frieda if she wanted to play horse. She gave him an eager smile that said,
"Yes, of course. Be my friend."
It sort of broke his heart.
19. Luke had no tests the following day, either, and nobody even bothered taking his vitals. He helped Connie, one of the janitors, carry 2 mattresses from the elevator to a couple of rooms in the east wing, got a single lousy token for his trouble. All the janitors were miserly when it came to handing out tokes. And on his way back to his room, he encountered Maureen standing by the ice machine, drinking from the bottle of water she always kept chilling in there. He asked if she needed any help.
No, I'm fine.
Then lowering her voice,
Hendricks and Zeke were talking out front by the flagpole. I saw them. Have they been testing you?
No, not for 2 days.
That's what I thought. This is Friday. You might have until Saturday or Sunday, but I wouldn't take that chance.
The mixture of worry and compassion he saw on her haggard face terrified him. Tonight. He didn't speak the word aloud, only mouthed it with a hand at the side of his face, scratching below his eye. She nodded. Maureen, do they know you have... He couldn't finish, and didn't have to.
They think it's sciatica.
Her voice was barely a whisper.
Hendrix might have an idea, but he doesn't care. None of them do, as long as I keep working. Go on, Luke. I'll turn your room while you're at lunch. Look under your mattress when you go to bed. Good luck.
She hesitated.
I wish I could hug you, son.
Luke felt his eyes fill up. He hurried away before she could see. He ate a big lunch, although he wasn't particularly hungry. He would do the same at supper. He had a feeling that if this worked, he was going to need all the fuel he could take on. That evening at dinner, he and Avery were joined by Frida, who seemed to have imprinted on Luke. After they went out to the playground, Luke declined to shoot more hoops with the girl, saying he would spot Avery for a while on the trampoline. One of those red neon words bloomed in Luke's mind as he watched the Avester jump up and down, doing lackadaisical seat drops and tummy bounces.
Tonight?
Luke shook his head. But I need you to sleep in your own room. I'd like to get a full 8 hours for once. Avery slid off the trampoline and looked at Luke solemnly.
Don't tell me what isn't true, because you think someone will see me looking sad and wonder why. I don't have to look sad.
And he stretched his lips in a hopelessly counterfeit grin. Okay, just don't fuck up my chance, Avester.
Come back for me if you can, please.
I will. The dots were returning, bringing a vivid memory of the immersion tank. Luke thought it was the effort it took to consciously send his thoughts. Avery looked at him a moment longer, then ran to the basketball hoop.
Want to play horse, Frida?
She looked down on him and gave him a smile.
Kid, I'd beat you like a drum. Spot me an H and an O, and we'll see about that.
They played as the light began to drain out of the day. Luke crossed the playground and looked back once as Avery, who Harry Cross had once called Luke's little bitty buddy, attempted a hook shot that missed everything. He thought Avery would come down to his room that night at least long enough to retrieve his toothbrush, but he didn't. 20. Luke played a few games of slapdash and 100 balls on his laptop, then brushed his own teeth, undressed to his shorts, and got into bed. He turned off the lamp and reached under his mattress. He might have cut his fingers on the knife Maureen had left him. Unlike the plastic ones they got in the calf, this felt like a paring knife with a real blade, if she hadn't wrapped it in a washcloth. There was something else as well, something he could identify by touch. God knew he'd used plenty of them before coming here. A flash drive. He leaned over in the dark and slipped both items into the pocket of his pants. Then came waiting. For a while, kids ran up and down the corridor, maybe playing tag, maybe just grab-assing around. This happened every night now that there were more kids. There were whoops and laughter, followed by exaggerated hushing sounds, followed by more laughter. They were blowing off steam, blowing off fear. One of tonight's loudest whoopers was Stevie Whipple, and Luke deduced that Stevie had been into the wine or hard lemonade. There were no stern adults demanding silence. Those in charge weren't interested in enforcing noise abatement rules or imposing curfews. Finally, Luke's part of the residence floor settled down. Now there was just the sound of his own steadily beating heart and the turn of his thoughts as he went over Maureen's list for the final time. Back to the trampoline once you're out, he reminded himself. Use the knife if you have to, then a slight turn to the right. If he got out. He was relieved to find himself 80% determined and only 20% afraid. Even that much fear made no real sense, but Luke supposed it was natural. What drove the determination, what he absolutely knew, was simple and stark. This was his chance, the only one he'd have, and he intended to make the most of it. When the corridor outside had been silent for what he judged to be half an hour, Luke got out of bed and grabbed his plastic ice bucket from on top of his TV. He had made up a story for the watchers, if, that was, anyone was actually watching the monitors at this hour, and not just sitting in some lower-level surveillance room and playing solitaire. This story was about a kid who goes to bed early, then awakens for some reason, maybe a need to pee, maybe because of a nightmare. Anyway, the kid is still more asleep than awake. So he walks down the hall in his underwear. Cameras and dusty bulbs watch him as he goes to the ice machine for a refill. And when he returns with not just a bucket of ice, but the scoop as well, they assume the kid's just too dozy to realize he still has it in his hand. He'll see it in the morning, lying on his desk or in the bathroom sink, and wonder how it got there. In his room again, Luke put some ice in a glass, filled it from the bathroom tap, and drank half of it down. It was good. His mouth and throat were very dry. He left the scoop on the toilet tank and went back to bed. He tossed and turned. He muttered to himself, maybe the kid in the story he was making up is missing his little bitty buddy. Maybe that's why he can't get back to sleep. And maybe nobody's watching or listening, but maybe somebody is, and that's the way he has to play it. Finally, he turned on the lamp again and got dressed. He went into the bathroom, where there was no surveillance, probably no surveillance, and stuck the scoop down the front of his pants, dropping his twin's t-shirt over it. If there was video in here, and if someone was monitoring it, he was probably cooked already. There was nothing he could do about that but push on to the next part of his story. He left the room and went down the hall to the lounge. Stevie Whipple and some other kid, one of the newbies, were there, lying on the floor, fast asleep. Half a dozen fireball nips, all empty, were scattered around them. Those little bottles represented a lot of tokens. Stevie and his new friend would wake up with hangovers and empty pockets. Luke stepped over Stevie and went into the caff. With only the salad bar fluorescents lit, the place was gloomy and a little spooky. He grabbed an apple from the never-empty bowl of fruit and took a bite as he wandered back into the lounge, hoping no one was watching, hoping that if someone was, they would understand the pantomime he was acting out and buy it. The kid woke up. The kid got ice from the machine and had a nice cold glass of water, but after that he's more awake than ever, so he goes up to the caff for something to eat. Then the kid thinks, hey, why not go out to the playground for a while, get some fresh air? He wouldn't be the first one to do that. Kalisha said that she and Iris had gone out several times to look at the stars. They were incredibly bright out here with no light pollution to obscure them. Or sometimes, she said, kids used the playground at night to make out. He just hoped no one was out here stargazing or necking tonight. There wasn't. And with no moon, the playground was fairly dark. The various pieces of equipment only angular shadows. Without a buddy or two for company, little kids had a tendency to be afraid of the dark. Bigger kids, too, although most wouldn't admit it. Luke strolled across the playground, waiting for one of the less familiar night caretakers to appear and ask him what he was doing out here with that scoop hidden under his shirt. Surely he wasn't thinking about escape, was he? Because that would be pretty darn wacky. Wacky, Luke murmured, and sat down with his back to the chain-link fence. That's me, a real whack job. He waited to see if someone would come. No one did. There was only the sound of crickets and the hoot of an owl. There was a camera, but was anybody really monitoring it? There was security, he knew that, but it was sloppy security. He knew that too. Just how sloppy, he would now find out. He lifted his shirt and removed the scoop. In his imaginings of this part, he scooped behind his back with his right hand, maybe shifting over to his left when his arm got tired. In reality, this didn't work very well. He scraped the scoop against the bottom of the chain link repeatedly, making a noise that sounded very loud in the stillness, and he couldn't see if he was making any progress. This is crazy, he thought. Throwing worry about the camera aside, Luke got on his knees and began to dig under the fence, flinging gravel to the right and the left. Time seemed to stretch out. He felt that hours were passing. Was anyone in that surveillance room he'd never seen but could imagine vividly starting to wonder why the kid with insomnia hadn't come back from the playground? Would he or she send someone to check? And say, what if the camera has a night vision feature, Lukey? What about that? He dug. He could feel sweat starting to oil his face, and the bugs working the night shift were homing in on it. He dug. He could smell his armpits. His heart had sped up to a gallop. He felt someone standing behind him, but when he looked over his shoulder, he saw only the gantry of the basketball post standing against the stars. Now he had a trench under the bottom of the fence. Shallow, but he had come to the Institute skinny and had lost more weight since then. Maybe. But when he lay down and tried to slide under, the fence stopped him. It wasn't even close. Go back in. Go back in and get into bed before they find you and do something horrible to you for trying to get out of here. But that wasn't an option, only cowardice. They were going to do something horrible to him. The movies, the headaches, the Stasi lights, and finally, the drone. He dug, gasping now, going back and forth, left and right. The gap between the bottom of the fence and the ground slowly deepened. So stupid of them to have left the surface unpaved on either side of the fence. So stupid not to have run an electrical charge, even a mild one, through the wire. But they hadn't, and here he was. He lay down again, tried again to ease under, and again the bottom of the fence stopped him. But he was close. Luke got on his knees again and dug more, dug faster, left and right, back and forth, to and fro. There was a snapping sound when the scoop's handle finally let go. Luke tossed the handle aside and went on digging, feeling the edge of the scoop bite into his palms. When he paused to look at them, he saw they were bleeding. Got to be this time. Got to be. But he still couldn't quite fit. And so back to work with the scoop, left and right, starboard and larboard. Blood was dripping down his fingers. His hair was sweat-pasted to his forehead. Mosquitoes sang in his ears. He put the scoop aside, lay down, and tried again to slide under the fence. The protruding tines pulled his shirt sideways, then bit into his skin, drawing more blood from his shoulder blades. He kept going. Halfway under, he stuck. He stared at the gravel, saw the way dust puffed up in tiny swirls below his nostrils as he panted. He had to go back. Had to dig deeper yet. Maybe only a little. Except when he tried to edge back into the playground, he discovered he couldn't go that way either. Not just stuck. Caught. He would still be here, trapped under this goddamn fucking fence like a rabbit in a trap when the sun came up tomorrow morning. The dots started to come back. Red and green and purple, emerging from the bottom of the dug-up ground that was only an inch or two from his eyes. They rushed toward him, breaking apart, coming together, spinning and strobing. Claustrophobia squeezed his heart, squeezed his head, his hands throbbed and sang. Luke reached out, hooked his fingers into the dirt, and pulled with everything he had. For a moment, the dots filled not only his field of vision, but his entire brain. He was lost in their light. Then the bottom of the fence seemed to rise a little. That might have been strictly imagination, but he didn't think so. He heard it creak. Maybe, thanks to the shots and the tank, I'm a TK Paws now, he thought, just like George. He decided it didn't matter. The only thing that mattered was that he had begun to move once more. The dot subsided. If the bottom of the fence really had risen, it had come back down. Metal prongs scored not just his shoulder blades, but his buttocks and thighs. There was an agonizing moment when he stopped again, the fence grasping him greedily, not wanting to let go. But when he turned his head and laid his cheek on the pebbly ground, he could see a bush. It might be in reach. He stretched, came up short, stretched some more, and grasped it. He pulled. The bush began to tear free. But before it could come entirely out of the ground, he was moving again, thrusting with his hips and pushing with his feet. A protruding fence tine gave him a goodbye kiss, drawing a hot line across one calf and then he wriggled through to the far side of the fence. He was out. Luke swayed to his knees and cast a wild look back, sure he'd see all the lights coming on, not just in the lounge, but in the hallways and the cafeteria, and in their glow he would see running figures, caretakers with their zapsticks unholstered and turned up to maximum power. There was no one. He got to his feet and began to run blindly, the vital next step, orientation, forgotten in his panic. He might have run into the woods and become lost there before reason reasserted itself, except for the sudden scorching pain in his left heel as he came down on a sharp rock and realized he had lost one of his sneakers in that final desperate lunge. Luke returned to the fence, bent, retrieved it, and put it on. His back and buttocks only smarted, but that final cut into his calf had been deeper and burned like a hot wire. His heartbeat slowed, and clear thinking returned.
Once you're out, go level with the trampoline,
Avery had said, relaying the second of Maureen's steps.
Put your back to it, then turn right one medium-sized step. That's your direction. You only have a mile or so to go, and you don't need to keep in a perfectly straight line. What you're aiming for is pretty big, but try your best.
Later, in bed that night, Avery had said that maybe Luke could use the stars to guide him. He didn't know about that stuff himself. All right, then. Time to go. But there was one other thing he had to do first. He reached up to his right ear and felt the small circle embedded there. He remembered someone, maybe Iris, maybe Helen, saying the implant hadn't hurt her because her ears were already pierced. Only pierced earrings unscrewed. Luke had seen his mother do it. This one was fixed in place.
Please, God, don't let me have to use the knife.
Luke steeled himself, worked his nails under the curved upper edge of the tracker, and pulled. His earlobe stretched, and it hurt plenty, but the tracker remained fixed. He let go, took two deep breaths, memories of the immersion tank recurring as he did so, and pulled again, harder. The pain was worse this time, but the tracker remained in place and time was passing. The West Residence Wing, looking strange from this unfamiliar angle, was still dark and quiet. But for how long? He thought about pulling again, but that would only be postponing the inevitable. Maureen had known. It was why she left the paring knife. He took it from his pocket, being careful not to pull out the thumb drive as well, and held it in front of his eyes in the scant starlight. He felt for the sharp edge with the ball of his thumb, then reached across his body with his left hand and pulled down on his earlobe, stretching it as far as it would go, which was not very. He hesitated, taking a moment to let himself really understand he was on the free side of the fence. The owl hooted again, a sleepy sound. He could see fireflies stitching the dark, and even in this moment of extremity, realized they were beautiful. Do it fast, he told himself. Pretend you're slicing a piece of steak. And don't scream, no matter how much it hurts. You cannot scream. Luke put the top of the blade against the top of his earlobe on the outside and stood that way for a few seconds that felt like a few eternities. Then he lowered the knife. I can't. You must. I can't. Oh, God, I have to. He placed the edge of the knife against that tender, unarmored flesh again and pulled down at once before he had time to do more than pray for the edge to be sharp enough to do the job in a single stroke. The blade was sharp, but his strength failed him a little at the last moment, and instead of coming off, the earlobe dangled by a shred of gristle. At first, there was no pain, just the warmth of blood flowing down the side of his neck. Then the pain came. It was as if a wasp, one as big as a pint bottle, had stung him and injected its poison. Luke inhaled in a long, sibilant hiss, grasped the dangling earlobe, and pulled it off like skin from a chicken drumstick. He bent over it, knowing he had gotten the damn thing, but needing to see it anyway, needing to be positive. It was there. Luke made sure he was even with the trampoline. He put his back to it, then turned a step, a medium one, he hoped, to the right. Ahead of him was the dark bulk of the northern Maine woods, stretching for God only knew how many miles. He looked up and spotted the Big Dipper, with one corner star straight ahead. Keep following that, he told himself. That's all you have to do. It won't be straight on till morning, either, she told Avery. It's only a mile or so, and then it's on to the next step. Ignore the pain in your shoulder blades, the worst pain in your calf, the worst pain of all in your Van Gogh ear. Ignore the way your arms and legs are trembling. Get going. But first, he drew his fisted right hand back to his shoulder and flung the scrap of flesh in which the tracker was still embedded over the fence. He heard, or imagined he heard, the small click it made as it struck the asphalt surrounding the playground's paltry excuse for a basketball court. Let them find it there. He began to walk, eyes up and fixed on that one single star. 21. Luke had it to guide him for less than 30 seconds. As soon as he entered the trees, it was gone. He stopped where he was, the institute still partly visible behind him through the first interlacing branches of the woodlands. Only a mile, he told himself, and you should find it even if you go off course a little, because she told Avery it's big, fairly big, anyway. So walk slowly. You're right-handed, which means you're right-side dominant, so try to compensate for that, but not too much, or you'll go off course to the left, and keep count. A mile should be between 2,000 and 2,500 steps. Ballpark figure, of course, depending on the terrain. And be careful not to poke your eye out on a branch. You've got enough holes in you already. Luke began walking. At least there weren't any thickets to plow through. These were old-growth trees, which had created a lot of shade above and a thick layer of underbrush discouraging pine duff on the ground. Every time he had to detour around one of the elderly trees, probably they were pines, but in the dark, who really knew, he tried to reorient himself and continue on a straight line which was now, he had to admit it, largely hypothetical. It was like trying to find your way across a huge room filled with barely glimpsed objects. Something on his left made a sudden grunting sound and then ran, snapping one branch and rattling others. Luke, the city boy, froze in his tracks. Was that a deer? Christ, what if it was a bear? A deer would be running away, but a bear might be hungry for a midnight snack. It might be coming at him now, attracted by the smell of blood. God knew Luke's neck and the right shoulder on his shirt were soaked with it. Then the sound was gone, and he could only hear crickets and the occasional hoo of that owl. He had been at 800 steps when he heard the whatever it was. Now he began to walk again, holding his hands out in front of him like a blind man, ticking the steps off in his mind. 1,000. 1,200. Here's a tree, a real monster. The first branches far over my head, too high up to see. Go around. 1,400. 1,500. He stumbled over a downed trunk and went sprawling. Something, a stub of a branch, dug into his left leg high up, and he grunted with pain. He lay on the duff for a moment, getting his breath back and longing, here was the ultimate deadly absurdity, for his room back in the institute. A room where there was a place for everything and everything was in its place and no animals of indeterminate size went crashing around in the trees. A safe place. Yeah, until it's not, he whispered and got to his feet, rubbing the new tear in his jeans and the new tear in his skin beneath. At least they don't have dogs, he thought, remembering some old black-and-white prison flick where a couple of chained-together cons had made a dash for freedom with a pack of bloodhounds baying behind them. Plus, those guys had been in a swamp where there were alligators. See, Lukey, he heard Kalisha saying. It's all good. Just keep going. Straight line. Straight as you can, anyway. At 2,000 steps, Luke started looking for lights up ahead, shining through the trees. There's always a few, Maureen had told Avery, but the yellow one is the brightest. At 2,500, he began to feel anxious. At 3,500, He began to be sure he had gone off course, and not just by a little. It was that tree I fell over, he thought. That goddamn tree. When I got up, I must have gone wrong. For all I know, I'm headed for Canada. If the Institute guys don't find me, I'll die in these woods. But because going back wasn't an option, he couldn't have retraced his steps even if he wanted to. Luke kept walking, hands waving in front of him for branches that might try to wound him in new places. His ear throbbed. He quit counting his steps, but he must have been around 5,000, well over 2 miles, when he saw a faint yellowy-orange gleam through the trees. Luke first mistook it for either a hallucination or one of the dots, soon to be joined by swarms of them. Another dozen steps put paid to those worries. The yellow-orange light was clearer, and had been joined by 2 more, much dimmer. Those had to be electric lights. He thought the brighter one was an arc sodium, the kind they had in big parking lots. Rolf's father had told them one night when he had taken Luke and Rolf to a movie at the AMC Southdale that those kinds of lights were supposed to stop muggings and car break-ins. Luke felt an urge to simply bolt forward and restrained it. The last thing he wanted to do was trip over another downed tree or step in a hole and break his leg. There were more lights now, but he kept his eyes firmly fixed on the first one. The Big Dipper hadn't lasted long, but here was a new guiding star, a better one. 10 minutes after first spotting it, Luke came to the edge of the trees. Across 50 yards or so of open ground, there was another chain-link fence. This one topped with barbed wire, and there were light posts along it at roughly 30-foot intervals. Motion activated, Maureen had told Avery. Tell Luke to stay well back. That was advice he hardly needed. Beyond the fences were little houses. Very little. Not enough room to swing a cat in, Luke's own father might have said. They could contain 3 rooms at most, and probably just 2. They were all the same. Avery said Maureen called this the village,